friendly president who works for a well-known environmental organization warned me not long ago, the environment is top of mind for many folks now. The polls support him. Earlier this month, polling outfit Ipsos reported that an overwhelming 85% of Canadians are concerned about climate change. And just look at the politicians. They're all talking about the environment now, even if they weren't before. As someone who is concerned about how we humans live on this planet, I have to say I am happy indeed. Some of you will probably know that it's one of my personal bandwagons. I'm a bit cynical, though. We'll see how it goes. As it happens, Beacon's Worship Committee has put together a series on the environment for us to consider. Today, I will focus on not only Christian and Western theology, but some other world religions' views about the environment. It's a hopeful picture in some places, but not so much in others. And you'll remember that Allegra Sloman spoke a few weeks ago about garbage. Yes, she mentioned landfill as well as mindfill and timefill, all of which are leftovers from a less than wholesome way of living. And in the middle of April, Gwenda Woodbury will share with us some of her insights and her passion into the global warming debate. Some people think it's still a debate. And then on Earth Day, April 22nd, we will celebrate our interdependent relationship with animals in our Blessings of the Animals service. Yes, we will have lots of pets, whether in person or by proxy. You're invited to bring them. How we view the environment, and especially our human relationship to the environment, affects how we treat the earth. Fundamentally, our attitude to the environment affects how we live. What do we do with our leftovers? What kind of house do we live in? What kind of vehicle do we drive? And how often do we drive it? Our opinion on these matters reflects our core values. Our chosen theology may support us or challenge us, depending on our reading of our particular scriptures. We affirm in our Unitarian statement of values, and if you look in the hymnal, they're just before the first hymn. The seventh principle is that we have respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. Some of us see this as a theological statement as well as a scientific one. Let's think about how this statement fits into other parts of the world and their thinking on the place of humans in nature. I want to start with indigenous people, those folks who perhaps live closest to the land itself, their particular land. Scholar John Grimm reminds us that the 200 million people who today would be considered indigenous represent thousands of different societies, each with their unique set of languages, kinship systems, rituals, and mythologies. Yet there are a number of similarities. Their life ways, their whole context of their lives, often show not only a remarkable intimacy with their bioregion, but they include ritual practices and ways of living which honor that relationship to their land. Grimm gives us an example, the Iroquois, which challenged decisions made by their tribal confederacy because of what they saw as the long-term impact of this particular decision on the seventh generation of living beings. An example of indigenous thinking comes from the Lakota thinker Luther Standing Bear. In 1933, he wrote, "All this was in accordance with the Lakota belief that man, meaning humankind, did not occupy a special place in the eyes of Wonkantanka, the grandfather of us all. I was only a part of everything that was called the world." Grimm goes on to relate that while indigenous peoples did not invent the idea of ecology, many of them do incorporate such practices, such ways of relating to the world. He says, "Care for the earth is woven into the governance systems of indigenous people, And when these systems break down, often the restraint and the continence guarding life is lost. He goes on, they have maintained a loving experience of place and an understanding that spiritual forces capable of leading humans into both utilitarian and self-understandings abide in all of these places. Indigenous peoples are connected to their land in ways we struggle to know ourselves, to even understand about. When our Western ways of thinking and doing collide with theirs, they usually lose. Our now secular way of being is often attributed to the mindset articulated in Genesis. Man, and I use that word on purpose, was to, quote, have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. And over women too, of course. And consequently, that power has corrupted us all, men and women, in the end. Theologians within Christianity and Judaism are working hard to reconnect with that kinship with the land that the indigenous Hebrew tribes probably had. They're asking questions about what Christian stewardship might mean from an ecological standpoint. If we read both the Christian and Hebrew scriptures with ecological awareness, what else do we see? Environmental ethics are there if we have eyes to see. For example, the Psalms celebrate nature and link redemption with creation. The Revelation vision of a new Jerusalem on earth, which concludes the New Testament, shows a city of justice and well-being with springs of living water. Other texts may have to be thoroughly reinterpreted, going well beyond the traditional canonical meanings and going beyond our destructive ways of living. There are lots of folks doing this too. Cultural historian and priest Thomas Berry writes, "Our great work is to support a new pattern of human presence on this planet." He advocates a whole new creation story, a whole new cosmology that is less human-centric in its assumptions. And Thomas Berry is a Catholic priest, too. We're back to another version of the interdependent web, that interdependent web of which we are a part, not on top of, that we started with. Both Christianity and Judaism have vocal feminist interpreters. A feminist lens connects the oppression women have felt with the oppression of the environment. Reading some authors like Mary Daly in her book Gyne Ecology, The Metaethics of Radical Feminism, made me quite angry, not only for her expose of women's subservient place in the world, but also how identified with nature and evil together in women are in the minds of some men and some societies. Ours included, perhaps especially ours. Feminist theology is a critique of traditional Christian and Jewish theology and points a way forward. The first step in any transformation is new eyes on the past. Some Unitarians are Buddhist in their theological leanings. What does Buddhism say on the topic of the environment? Buddhist religious scholar Rita Gross says that a rhetoric of reverence for nature is insufficient for an environmental ethic. When a society gains so much technology that is so easily able to destroy nature, then choices have to be made to limit excessive reproduction and consumption. One of the basic aspects of the Buddhist worldview is interdependence, and that does resonate well with environmental concerns. Nothing can stand alone from the matrix of all else, she says. Nothing and no one can exist alone without depending on others, whether other people or other sentient beings or other aspects of the earth. And everything we do affects the rest of the universe. Gross goes on to describe some of the ethics that leads to the limits we must put on ourselves. We must limit our consumption, and we need to limit our reproduction. She admits that this has not been discussed much in the Buddhist literature, in the Buddhist world. She recognizes that while a religious tradition may have the scripture to support good environmental practice, it is not necessarily followed. And of course, Buddhism isn't alone. I feel like I have touched so lightly on how religious worldviews see environmental ethics that I cannot do any of them justice. There is so much out there, from collections of essays published the old way in books and on paper, to websites with articles and ways of doing it. I find it hopeful that so many people are articulating such fundamental reasons and values to support environmental actions. I want to move from abstract theory to my usual question in sermons. So what? Does this theology, does this topic matter? How does it matter to me personally? All of this is to convince us, use whichever reason works for you, to think ecologically, to think environmentally, and to act environmentally. We've moved to the hard part, from theory to action, from talking to doing. What do I need to do to be green? Rick Mercer was working hard to convince us to take the one-ton challenge a few years ago to save a ton of greenhouse gases. Of course, we know that that federal government program has been canceled. Hopefully others will come forward. That particular environmental advocacy organization I mentioned at the beginning also has a program to encourage us to think and act ecologically. I've summarized the Suzuki Foundation's Nature Challenge on the inside of the back cover of your order of service, along with the reference so that you can get more details if you would like. I know many of us are already doing many of these things. Me too. Our new car is one of those small, fuel-efficient ones. Not the very smallest car. Lizzie and the cats want a spot to sit on too. But it is about twice as efficient as our truck. I'm sure each of you can find at least one challenge in that list, though. Something to work on further. There is a Unitarian Universalist group called UU Ministry for the Earth that has its own challenge, a 10-tree challenge, as well as a green sanctuary program. Could we buy and plant 10 trees a year? I know we're rather well-treed here on the wet coast. Maybe we could find spots for 10 trees, though. The green sanctuary program starts with an assessment, an audit. How are we as a congregation doing with our way of living? Is there a way that we can make that a little bit more conservative in the way of conserving the earth? And how can we as individuals do this? They remind us that sustainable living is not about material comfort. It is about choosing to live in a way that nurtures life, builds relationship, and rejects material consumption as the sole determinant of happiness. This group used to be called the Seventh Principle Project. We're back to that statement of principle again, back to that image of the interdependent web of which we are a part. I try to remember that I'm a node on it, an intersection, not the spider who uses the web for her own benefit. Many of us dabble at sustainable living. You know, replace a few incandescent bulbs with the fluorescent ones, buy a more fuel-efficient car, take transit when we can. These are all good steps. But I know I can do more if only I would get around to it, if only I made it a priority. As soon as it stops raining a bit, I could finally dig out the storm windows for my old house that are tucked away under the crawl space and get the broken glass replaced and replace the hardware, so come fall, I would have a warmer house. Some of these things we need to do are one-time things. Some of them are like diets. You have to keep making the decision over and over and over every time there's an opportunity to go either way. I'm hoping that understanding just a little of the theology and deciding which one is yours will help you stick to your environmental diet. And that's that there's one more reason for you and me to do the right things for our earth. It is the only one we have, after all. Blessed be.